WBPVLP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Ratia Murphy with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, July 21st. Criminal citations for sleeping outside in Sarasota have increased sharply over the past 6 years, rising from just 24 in 2020 to 343 last year. A new investigation by Suncoast Searchlight found the increase is largely tied to expanded police training, allowing more officers to enforce the city's lodging ordinance. While people cited are first offered shelter and services, advocates say limited shelter space and long wait list leave many with few options beyond citations, fines, or the court system. A Sarasota restaurant is closed indefinitely after an overnight electrical fire caused extensive damage. Pacific Rim, a fixture in Southside Village for nearly 30 years, caught fire early Saturday morning after flames broke out in the building's attic. No one was injured, but the restaurant sustained heavy smoke, water, and structural damage. The owners say they're committed to rebuilding and hope to reopen as soon as repairs are complete. A controversial expansion at Nathan Benderson Park has secured $10 million in state funding after supporters pitched the project as both an indoor sports complex and a regional storm shelter. The proposed 100,000-square-foot facility would host sports and community events while also serving as an emergency shelter and recovery hub during hurricanes. The project has drawn criticism from opponents who question its cost and whether it fits the park's original mission as a premier rowing venue. Congressman Greg Stoob has endorsed former congressional staffer Kellyanne Walker in the Republican primary for Florida House District 74. Stoob says Walker is the candidate he trusts to advance what he calls an America First agenda in Tallahassee. Walker previously worked for both Stoob and Congressman Vern Buchanan and is one of several Republicans seeking to replace the term-limited Representative James Buchanan. The Republican primary is August 18th. Governor Ron DeSantis has tapped U.S. Assistant Secretary of Labor Henry Mack to become Florida's next education commissioner. Mack previously served as a senior vice chancellor in the Florida Department of Education, overseeing higher education and workforce programs. He is also the runner-up in Florida Gulf Coast University's presidential search in 2023. If confirmed by the State Board of Education, he'll succeed Anastasius Kamoutsis, who recently became president of Polk State College. This has been Ratia Murphy with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, July 21st.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 92 of our changing environment. The previous show was Melody Matrix, hosted by Neil Rubidoux.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm Jono Miller, and this show is being recorded and broadcast on July 21st, 2026.
Today we are going to be talking with Sarasota Bay Watch Executive Director Rhonda Ryan about the Jim Neville Preserve, where it is, what it is, and what's happening there.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Rhonda, welcome back to the show. The last time we had you on, we talked generally about Sarasota Baywatch, and today we want to focus on one particular project with a number of dimensions. Let's start by telling our audience where the Neville Preserve is located.
Okay. Thank you for having me today, Julie and John. I appreciate being here. So the Jim Neville Marine Preserve is one of the programs that we work on. And the Jim Neville Marine Preserve is right inside of the Midnight Pass.
Keep talking.
Okay. So the...
Yes?
No. We seem to be having a little issue here.
Why don't just try my mic.
Okay. We'll share.
Yeah, where is it?
Okay, this is just a little pivot here. So in case you didn't hear me, I'm talking about the Jim Neville Marine Preserve today, which is right inside the Midnight Pass, and it can be accessed from the Turtle Beach boat ramp if you paddle around south or from the mainland.
And how big is the preserve?
Oh, the preserve is multi-acre. I'm not even sure how many. It's over 30 acres for sure. We are only working on a small portion of those.
Yeah, I think when some people in Sarasota hear the word preserve, they think, oh, well, if it's a preserve, it's going to be 300 acres or 3,000 acres or some giant thing. And this may be our smallest preserve in the county.
Yes, it's a very unique piece of property since it is a Sarasota County property, and being a preserve, it's under the Parks Department, and I know that they're trying to create some consistency among their lands and their properties, but it's quite difficult with the Jim Neville Marine Preserve because you can't actually access it very easily. We don't have parking, we don't have toilets, we don't have a playground. You have to have shallow draft boat to get there.
Right. So it's an island system, and it's unique. It may be the only preserve that's a complete mix of native habitat and completely altered, bizarro native habitat. So if we go back historically, one of the things that distinguished the bays in Sarasota on this coast of Florida were they're pretty shallow. And instead of relying on boats with shallow draft boats like catboats in the Bahamas and stuff, people wanted to have deeper draft boats. And so early on, people started dredging channels through our bays, and those kept getting more and more ambitious to accommodate deeper and deeper draft vessels. And so there was a group of islands inside of Midnight Pass, which were probably originally flood tidal shoals. They were probably sand that washed into the pass that was then colonized by mangroves. And so in the early 80s, whenever the Intracoastal Waterway was dredged, the dredge spoil, so dredging involved sucking up the sediment that was in the bay bottom where they wanted a channel and pumping it out. And so the best way I've come to understand or visualize what was going on is they ended up with this slurry, a mix of a lot of water, a lot of sand, and then some lumpier stuff, shell fragments and bigger pieces of rock probably. And so if you imagine making pancakes, and you have your pancake batter and you put maybe some little chopped walnuts or something in there, then when you sort of sploosh it down in the pan, it slowly spreads out and it'll widen and connect up with other incipient pancakes that you're making. And so that's exactly what happened with the spoil. They covered some of the mangrove islands that were called the Bird Keys with the bay bottom. And the heavier stuff more or less stayed in place, and the smaller and finer material spread out to the periphery. So if you were to do a cross-section in the center, you'd have larger chunks of stuff that didn't move so far, and then grading out into sand and probably even more like silty areas in some places. So that killed the mangroves. So we ended up with a preserve that consists of significant native mangrove areas with this completely unnatural soil type that was then colonized by exotic plants. And I'll let Rhonda talk about that.
Okay, Jono, I've never heard it referred to as a pancake, but I can see that. So, yes, what we had was the 100% mangrove island there, a typical bird key that you see along the water, and then a lot of the spoil was then placed on top of that. So the highest areas of Jim Neville are about 13 feet, and they're completely Australian pine, some pepper, carrot wood up there. But since the hurricanes, when some of those big Australian pines came down, you had these massive root pans, and the root pans are just full of shell and debris. We've actually found a lot of pop-top cans that they, you know, quit making in the 80s, and a lot of old trash, some bottles and odd stuff out there. But, that's sort of the vegetation that we're seeing out there.
So I didn't check this morning, but the waterway system is maintained by WCIND, the West Coast Inland Navigation District. And this is an authority that actually levies taxes. They raise money through assessments. And I fault them because when they first did these projects, I think anyone who's looked into it, when an Australian pine germinates and it's a foot tall, a Cub Scout could pull it up. But if you let it get 3 or 4 feet tall, you'll have a back injury. So it would have been easy for the West Coast Inland Navigation District to engage volunteers to go out annually and just pull up what was invading and creeping into this new habitat. Julie and I were involved in a study in the early 70s, and the premise of the study, which was looking at spoil islands on the West Coast, the premise involved asking the question, how do these islands get colonized? Like, you're taking a totally new soil, putting it somewhere that's not connected to the mainland, and what plants show up? Well, we know a lot of what plants show up are Australian pine and Brazilian pepper. Now, since then, this plant called carrotwood has become, so there wasn't really any carrotwood to speak of in 1971. There was one on Bayshore Road that I knew of, but it wasn't common. So we ended up with all this invasive exotic vegetation, and it's believed to be less desirable than our native plants. Now, we know that ospreys and other birds will perch in the Australian pines, and we know crows and other birds feed on the fruit of the carrotwood. But, Rhonda, there's a student who's been studying birds out there, and could you tell us about what she's been doing and what she's been finding?
Yes, we have a student that works with us. We actually have about 30-some students that work with us. But this particular student, her name is Sophia Hackman. She is a Pineview student. And when we started the intense restoration work, which was a couple years ago, and we were planting native plants, the interest was what can we attract with this? So what we were trying to do is create habitat where there wasn't any habitat. And this student said, well, you know, I like birds. I could do a bird count out here. And so we ended up intertwining her bird counts to verify the plantings and actually give us data about the value of the habitat that we were creating. And so Sophia, which is, you know, she's a teenage student, exceptional teenage student, has created this database of birds that we have there. And when you interface that with the plants, her findings have shown that there are greater numbers of birds now, and there are greater diversity of birds. Now, we compare restored areas where we have removed invasives and planted native species to unrestored areas, which we haven't touched at all. So that gives us some idea of how that is working. That particular framework of study has now also branched into the Alligator Creek area. And I'm really proud to say that both of those studies are studies that are being done by Florida young birders. And that's very important that we have youth that is involved with the environmental work that's being done here, and they are allowed to have their interests expand and have a site.
So how do you reach the Jim Neville Preserve?
Well, there's a couple ways. A long time ago, I worked on the Jim Neville Preserve in like 2010. Mm-hmm. We used to take some Pineview students at that point in time out of what is now Big Waters, and we would kayak over. And I'm embarrassed to say that I actually took them to a really skanky place. It was very stagnant. You know, we kind of slogged through mud getting there. We worked with the Sarasota County Jim Tadgy at that point in time. And we worked on getting rid of pepper and carrot wood. Currently, what we do is we leave from the Vamo Drive boat ramp from the mainland, and it's a 15-minute paddle over. And I just want to reiterate, this is county property. It's open to anyone. So we, Sarasota Baywatch, has a fleet of kayaks. We also have a little skiff. And we transport people over there. So for the volunteers and students that are a part of that, it's not uncommon to have somebody who said, I have never kayaked before. So, you know, we're providing that opportunity too.
So Sophia has recorded, I think, close to 100 different species. And if you asked people, if you said, well, we're talking about a site that has carrot wood and Australian pine, and it's in the bay, what would you expect to see? And so you'd have ospreys and an eagle and night herons and, you know, a bunch of stuff that would be pretty predictable. But she's found northern Parula warblers out there, the ground doves, like all sorts of really interesting, Carolina wrens, American Red Start. I mean, birds that I would be feel honored to see in our yard are showing up in this created, recreated habitat that is existing because of the diverse plants that have been added. And like over 70 species of native plants have been added out there. So talk about the effort to replant and how that works and how they survive in droughts and the whole system you've worked out.
Well, that could be a big long story. Yeah. because we had just a little bit of wind in the middle of that. Yeah. So, we started the restoration project a couple of years ago. And that involved, you know, paddling our plants over there. Even though it's an island, you need to remember that these plants are not necessarily saltwater plants. The ones like the mangroves and the salt-tolerant ones on the perimeter are, but the other plants are not. So that means that you need to haul the water over. We have just gone through an impressive drought, and to keep some of our plantings alive, we usually transport about 35 to 40 2.5-gallon jugs of water. We have about 2.5 miles of trail, so that means that a person could be carrying about 40 pounds of water, maybe a mile, to make sure that those plantings, manually we probably water about 87 gallons each time we go out there, which is a feat in itself. We do have a couple collection things, devices out there, small ones, but, you know, when it's a drought, it's a problem. So we always need to be planting for the drought. And actually, after the hurricanes, realize that when there's a big storm like that, you could have 4 feet of inundation. So that was another pivot point as far as what we're doing out there. We had been doing work out there, had some trails, had some plants, but then the storm took out about 1,000 Australian pines, and of course many of those went down on the trails that we had already formed and on some of the plantings. So there was a little bit of backtracking at that point in time. But the trails out there, if you go out there, are color-coded. There is a map out there so you don't get lost. There are some, you know, kind of couple little signs to help you. But it's an interesting, and now that it's raining, really beautiful place to be.
And what are some of the plants that seem to be thriving or doing better than others?
So we planted a variety of plants over the last couple of years, and it's not always what you predict. The Biden Alba has done very well. Dune Sunflower, yeah. Biden's Alba always does well. Anybody who's worked around it knows that if you've worked around it, you're probably getting that out of your dryer filter there. We have some mahoganies out there. The gumbo limbo's done really well. We've worked on trying to get some bigger plants at those higher elevations because we'd like to have a little more shade out there than we have. It can be a very hot place to work. Sable palms have done well, and live oak have done real well.
So were the sable palms seedlings?
Yes, they were seedlings. Yep.
Well, that's great. So, so just to go back in time a little, so we talked a little bit about the dredging and the creation of the islands, and then about 1980 or so, I think this region, so North Kasichee, South Siesta, Midnight Pass, the Oaks, and the Neville Preserve, maybe the most contentious area per square foot in the county. There's just been a lot of contention over the years, with whether it's Midnight Pass or the fate of the Oaks. So Jim Neville was sort of a curmudgeon-y guy. To be clear, he was an environmentalist. He was an early environmentalist. He shares something with Ted Sperling. Ted Sperling was a city environmentalist, and we know about both these guys now because they have places named after them. Mm-hmm. There were other early environmentalists like Earl Lyons and Fred Duesberg who did not have anything named after them, so we don't hear about them as much. But anyway, Jim Neville got well known as an environmental person because he had a column in the Herald Tribune called Meander Line, and he'd write these columns about his perspective on things. Now, he was I don't know if eccentric's the right word, but, you know, he was inclined to dump stuff in the bay and call it fish habitat, and some of us weren't crazy about that. But he did some good stuff. I think, and people can correct me, but I think what happened was when Mabry Carlton was a commissioner, and he died in surveying his ranch from an airplane, and the plane crashed, and he was a commissioner at the time. And so I believe, as a result, Jim Neville was appointed as a commissioner. And so he did something really good, which was he identified the fact that there were a lot of street ends on Siesta Key that terminated in the beach. And what's common with street ends or rights of way elsewhere is that the neighbors get together and they go to the government and say, look, nobody's ever going to use this roadway. Could you vacate it and we'll split the property between the two adjoining neighbors. But according to Rob Patton, Jim Neville had the insight to say, no, these should all be beach accesses. So big points to him for that. On the other hand, this was a time when the Oaks property was not a development. It was a holding of the Palmer family. And there was interest in acquiring the entire Oaks property, which included the north and south ends of North End of Kasichee Key and the south end of Siesta Key and the mainland and North Creek, and I guess Catfish Creek maybe. And so there was interest in acquiring that property as a county preserve or park. And so Jim Neville, as a commissioner, took county stationery and wrote a letter to the body in Tallahassee that reviewed land acquisition from the state funding perspective, and he told them, don't buy this Oaks property. You should be buying this, what became the Carlton Reserve. So that was highly inappropriate to use county stationery to send an official letter without the permission of the other commissioners. The Oaks eventually did go on the ballot for acquisition, and it's the only land acquisition referendum that Sarasota County's had that failed. And I think part of the reason it failed was that there was such a discrepancy between the amount of money the county, the referendum was asking for compared to what the assessed value was. So I think people raised some eyebrows about the discrepancy. Anyway, so that property wasn't acquired, but it was a you know, big deal at the time. So now we end up with a preserved named for a man who thought that area shouldn't be acquired. And there's a little irony there. But he was clearly an early environmentalist, just not one that had a deep ecological understanding, in my opinion.
So, Rhonda, how did the Australian pines in challenge your trail building out there?
Oh, well, you know, many of the Australian pines out there are quite old, and so they're very large, and, you know, they're crossed over all of the trails and plantings, and, you know, we have a group, I call them the Neville Rangers. I have a group of about four men who spearhead most of the work out there, and they love it. They go out there many times a week to take care of stuff. But it involved a lot of chainsaw work to kind of clear those areas up to make sure that we didn't have leaning and hanging trees that were going to, you know, cause a problem with safety. I know that the county did go out there at one point and worked on trying to help with some of that. The big problem that we have out there is once those areas are cleared, then you have the vegetative debris. So after, you know, we had some from areas that we had cleared so we could do plantings, but once the hurricane hit, now we have an excessive amount of wood that needs to be processed. And so currently what we're doing is, you know, we have them in piles. We've got vines growing over them to help with the degradation. We've got them separated out on the shore, you know, closer to the coast because of the concern of fire. We've had 3 out of 5 county commissioners out there that have accepted tours to the Jim Neville Marine Preserve, and they have unanimously loved the project and loved what we're doing out there. But, you know, we're always getting back to this topic of these debris piles and what can you do with it, because you can't get a barge up there. You can't get heavy equipment in there. We're not cutting mangroves for access, so it becomes quite an issue. So there's a lot of moving sticks and moving sticks and moving sticks, but, you know, I think that, you know, it's reducing itself, but still I don't know that that's really the cure that we're looking for.
It's a shame because of all the firewoods you can get locally, Australian pine is like really a great, it doesn't snap, crackle, and pop. It burns down to ash. But there's really, unless you're going to use helicopters, there's no functional way to get all that wood off of there. Yeah. So, and I've often thought, if people are unfamiliar with the Australian pine, one of the things that's distinctive about it is that its root system is almost completely horizontal, like within the top foot of the soil. And so it spreads out in this big circle, so, you know, around the trunk. And these things tip over. And so these big root masses, they can stick 8 feet or more up in the air. So I've often thought, well, somebody would want to go out and harvest these things and flip them upside down and pour some epoxy over them to make tables. So you'd have this, the trunk would be the support for the table, and then this beautiful, intricate, dendritic root system would be very handsome. But again, there's no straightforward way to do that. So another missed opportunity.
Yeah, that's an interesting viewpoint on that, actually, Jono. I kind of love that. There is a fair amount of time that's spent trying to, you know, cut the tree and then drop that root pan back into the hole, because otherwise you've got this big hole. I mean, we have root pans out there that are 20 feet in diameter. It's actually amazing. So, yeah, table. I hadn't thought of that before.
So let me reintroduce our guest. And she's Rhonda Ryan, and we're talking about the Jim Neville Preserve, where it is, what it is, and what's happening there. And then the Sarasota County UF IFAS Extension is hosting Shells and Shark's Teeth Art on Wednesday, August 5th, from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. During this program, attendees will learn about the animals that create seashells and the natural history that makes it possible for us to find fossilized shark teeth. The program will end with attendees making their own special piece of jewelry or a keychain. Jewelry making tools, materials, and shark teeth will be provided. This event will take place in the classroom at Shamrock Park in Venice. Registration is required. More information and registration is available by calling 941-861-5000.
So if there's one thing about islands, it's people like to fantasize what could be done with them. And when I went online, I found this elaborate drawing of, like, dredging through the bird keys and, like, connecting up all these waterways, and they were going to connect this to that and that to this. What's the backstory on that? How did that arise? And I imagine it was kind of short-lived, but what can you tell us about that?
Well, as far as the plans that have been in place for Jim Neville's, you know, the county has had Jim Neville's since the 1980s when it was granted to Sarasota County from the Palmer Trust. And at that point, it said that the property shall be left in its pristine and undeveloped state. So the things that have been happening out there, the county and maybe estuary program and some other, there's been a lot of people who have looked at it over the years, but there hasn't been a lot of action. And some of the plans did involve like mangrove tunnels and kayaking and opening those areas up. But what you need to think about is that a lot of those plans involved going right through the heart of that area, and those areas have a height of 13 feet. So any development project like that is going to involve a massive amount of soil and dirt movement, which is an extremely high cost. And I don't believe, you know, those ideas have come and gone. They've come across the table and left because of money. With this being part of Sarasota County Parks, I know that they have a lot of priorities, and Jim Neville doesn't really seem to be one of them, which is one of the advantageous parts of Sarasota Baywatch working in there, because they have a property that's actually being improved, you know, for free. And for us, the goal has been that this is a youth legacy project. And the goal was to have kids work on it, plant plants, be able to come back later, bring their kids to it and say, wow, look at that tree. I worked on that and I planted that tree. Now, we've already seen that some of the kids that were in our youth leadership program a couple years ago and were involved with planting they're in college now and actually graduating, but we've had kids get a group in their college, a science group together, get another college group together, and then go there and do studies themselves, which is actually a full circle. When they called and said, do you think we could do that? I thought, this is exactly what we want to see, is this use of this land and this expansion of the knowledge base that's there.
So we'll talk more about the groups and getting the youth involved, but we need to emphasize, I hope our listeners picked up on the fact that the legal document governing this property refers to it as pristine. And so this is what happens sometimes when you get attorneys writing about the environment. So, the mangroves, sure, we could call those pristine, but this was a completely artificial habitat that never existed before. There's never been a storm that's taken big chunks of the bay bottom and dropped them on top of mangroves and let the rain wash through it. So you end up with questions. I imagine there was some scrutiny when you wanted to start the project, that people were saying, well, the terms and conditions say it has to be left in its pristine condition. And maybe those Australian pines are pristine. So how did that all unfold?
Well, that's an interesting topic. And it, you know, when we started this, we have always worked within Sarasota County guidelines, and we have always been in touch with the Parks Department. And I've worked with a few people throughout the years and always worked under their guidance. And they were agreeable to having us work in a small area of land and see how that works. Now, the thing is that in many ways, it still is pristine. I mean, these are native plants that would be here normally. The mangroves, when they were on the islands before the dredging, that provided some habitat. But when you dump a bunch of bottom on top of it, then you've just negated all that. So one of the positive things about the work being done out at Neville is that every day that there is a plant that can offer some food value or shelter or some sort of self-existence for an animal, then that's a good day for them. And that's a day that's better than yesterday when it was all Australian pine.
So in the wake of the storms, are you seeing a lot of recruitment of peppers and carrotwood and pines coming back in?
Some. Yeah, some. So we have to stay on it. And, you know, anything when you're dealing with peppers and carrotwood, it's never ending. So we are doing that. The goal is if there's open space to make sure that we're getting something native planted in there that can then kind of compete for that area and that little space of land. So we're working a lot with ground covers, too, so just from a water standpoint.
So, Rhonda, you have some notes from John, who's a lead volunteer. Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah, John Ryan. So I have quite a few notes. Actually, if he wasn't in Ireland, he'd be a great guest for you to have right now. But he is someone who has dug into a lot of the history of Neville. Jono actually knows a large amount of that and actually different stuff than I'm aware of. But are you looking for the history or are you looking for the stuff that we're doing? And
yeah, the stuff that you're doing.
We're doing now. Okay, so currently we go out to the Neville Preserve officially twice a month. Now, other than that, the Neville Rangers go out there many times to do maintenance. But twice a month we do projects out there. One is a restoration project and one is the birding project. And these are open to anyone. They can sign up on the website for those. We have had multiple student groups out there, but we've had a lot of interest from special interest groups. We've had garden clubs come out. We've had butterfly groups, Florida Naturalist. I had a boys group home out there. There's just it's a great place. We've had some team building sessions out there where businesses have gotten hold of us and said, look, we want to do something as a company and we want to work together. And we've even had out-of-state groups contact us. They're here for a conference and they end up going out there. And those are very positive. And we're very open to doing that, taking people out there, you know, giving them a tour, giving them some history, giving them a chance to get dirty, work together. And there's lots of different projects that we do out there. You know, we've got our trail building and we've got our planting and we've got the watering and we've got the marine debris. So people can come out there and decide what they like to do and have something to do. So it's usually a half day trip out there. And we do have kayaks. So if you have your kayak and you want to go out there, you can with us. Or, you know, we have kayak spots.
Well, I guess people could visit the Jim Neville Preserve and then cautiously and carefully, wearing a PFD, head over to Midnight Pass. It is, you know, you talked about how high Neville Preserve may be on the county's list of things to do. all of a sudden midnight pass is the thing. And so it used to be there was a time when it was primarily kayakers that would pull up on the backside and walk over to the beach. But now that the pass is open, it is a definite boating destination. And the kayakers are still coming, and the force of the flow can be significant. People can get into trouble pretty readily. And, of course, access by first responders is really limited there. So if you do get into trouble, it's a double trouble because it's not like somebody can just drive up readily and assist. So if you do go to Midnight Pass, just be aware that there's can be a lot of traffic and the water conditions are dangerous. So that sort of leads into, you had mentioned previously that you have another project that actually deals with boats, and that has to do with prop scars and the grass flats around the preserve.
Yeah, now there's, like you mentioned, there's a lot of focus on Midnight Pass right now. There's multiple entities that are doing research in the pass, which is very exciting. And I think that it's important to remember that even when the pass was closed and the water was murkier, a lot more tannin, you know, maybe the water conditions weren't as good there, but it was still a habitat for manatee and dolphin. So there continue to be manatee and dolphin studies out there, fish studies, algae studies, flow studies. It's really exciting to see that there's so much work being done there. That's the past side. On the other side of the Jim Neville Marine Preserve, as you come out of the Siesta Key Turtle Beach boat ramp there, there are some significant prop scars in the seagrass beds there. And we are going to be working on a study regarding mitigation. So we're going to be taking a prop scar, putting in areas, taking a section, putting clams there, having a section with no clams, another one with clams, to just see if those clams are going to help with that seagrass recruitment there.
And are these quahogs?
These are the native southern hardshell clam, which is called a campy. All the shellfish work that we do use the native clams for this southern area that can withstand higher salinities and higher temperatures. So we don't use any hybrids in any of our projects, but these are campies that we'll be doing.
Now, Julie may correct me, but my recollection is that John Morrell said that there were areas where they found angel wing clams inside the pass.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
That wouldn't surprise me a bit.
Yeah.
We don't do anything with angel wing clams. That's not something that we, you know, we're not working on any kind of restoration with that, but it doesn't surprise me a bit. I think that the information, there are a lot of data sets about Midnight Pass. And now that the pass is flowing and there's much more interest in that, hopefully those data sets will be able to intersect and really give some great information. But with that being such, you know, Midnight Pass was such a hot topic for so many years. And, you know, now that it's open and people love going there and all the property owners are thrilled, their water is cleared up. They've got bait fish at their docks. They're able to, you know, the fishing's better. So there is going to be a lot of interest in that big pass area, obviously. And with that, you know, there will probably be a lot of interest in Jim Neville. So it's kind of hard to tell what the future of Jim Neville looks like. Once again, it is county property. But in the meantime, it's providing habitat, and it's providing an education experience, and it's providing, you know, hands-on learning for community members and students. And, you know, we have less Australian pines, and it's a great day on the water. You know, if you want to be in the water and go hike around a little island, it really serves the purpose, and it's a very unique piece of property because there's really nothing else like that, which is part of the dilemma.
Well, and part of what makes Midnight Pass so special and what made it special in the past is that this is a unstabilized pass. When we think about the passes on the west coast of Florida, most of them are have hardened shorelines along some part of it. And so, and the other thing is it's a more human scale pass. When you're talking about Big Pass or Boca Grande or some of the, those are like really overwhelming. I think the human scale of it, helps get people in trouble because it seems like, oh, well, maybe we could wade across it or, you know, something silly like that. But, yeah, I think a lot of its charm and character comes from the fact that it's all native on each side of the pass, and I hope we're able to continue that. I don't know the details. I think the county is one of the things they're contemplating is a sort of a dredging strategy that if it seemed to be closing, they could do a little surgery and keep it going, but well, that's another whole topic, I guess. So, Southwest Florida Water Management District yard watering and other restrictions continue as Sarasota continues to experience a rainfall deficit. So, watering hours are currently limited to 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. on your watering day. Car washing can be done on your watering day at any time, but only with a shut-off nozzle on the water hose. Fountains are limited to 4 hours a day. And Swift Mud, the Southwest Florida Water Management District, has directed public utility staff to issue citations without warning. So more information is available at scgov.net/water restrictions. And I will note for people that are interested in words that citation is a contronym. A citation can be both an award, something valuable. You got a citation for meritorious service, or it can also be a punishment or identifying negative behavior. So watch out when, be careful when you're getting a citation. Make sure it's the right kind. So tell us, Rhonda, tell us more about the student groups, how that started and what it's mushroomed into, and if people have, if young people are listening or parents are listening and they'd like their kids to consider it, how would that all unfold?
Okay, so Sarasota Baywatch, we've been around since 2006. And during that entire time, we've always had students involved with our projects. And as you know, students need community service hours so they can qualify for Bright Future scholarships. So anyone with a child that's in the high school range should be thinking about those community service because that equals dollars for their education. So we had a lot of students for many years, gave them community service, and then we decided that what we really wanted to do was do something more for the students. So we created the Youth Leadership Program. Currently, we have students from 7 different schools. I have about 34 students in that. And this is just such an exciting portion of our organization. It's sort of the succession plan in many ways. The kids are learning about the environment. Their science is being taken out of the classroom. They're learning leadership and communication skills. They're learning to speak. They're learning some career guidance. They're learning how we organize trips. Some of these kids, like I said, have never been on kayaks, and now they're learning to, you know, get them set up for volunteers. And the youth leadership program also teaches marine camp in 3 different schools after school to 4th and 5th graders. And that is a spectacular program because after your 4th and 5th grader has been in school all day and they have to stay for another hour, they are thrilled to see high schoolers come in because they're just so cool and talk about interesting things and have some hands-on activities that we do. So that is a double-sided education process that we're a part of, and we love it. The teenagers love it. The kids love it.
Did you say that, or did I hear that there are new colleges involved in some way?
Oh, yes. We have a new board member from New College, Dr. Sam Bedgood, and he is going to be leading our shellfish restoration. The previous lead, Ernesto Lasso de la Vega, we just had a celebration for him because he is going to be moving out of the area. He'll be bouncing back and forth. But Sam Bedgood is now taking over that position. He has some interns that are working on some of the work that we are doing, some of the restoration and research out at the lease. And, yeah, so we definitely have New College. We are, Sarasota Bay Watch has one of the EDAP, Environmental Discovery Award program interns this summer, too. So, yes, we're involved with New College, which is great because there's a lot of knowledge and interest up there. Dr. Sam Bedgood teaches aquaculture, and they currently are doing getting a whelk research study going based on some work out at our lease with moat, and you know, the whelks are predators for clams, so it's just very interesting to see how one thing leads to another.
Okay, so you covered New College. What about relationships with the with moat or with the estuary program?
Yes, we have very positive relationships with them. The estuary program has been out to Neville. I'm sure you want to bring it back to that. Has been out to Neville, worked, you know, we've spoken with them quite a bit. So we will be conferring with them in the future with concepts on that area. And I know that the estuary program recently hosted a Midnight Pass symposium with panels talking about a lot of the research that's going on there. As far as moat, we work with moat out at the clam lease, Kim Bezos Hall in particular, who works with eagle rays. So there's a lot of predator studies that are going on out there.
Okay, so for people that maybe tuned in late or their interest has grown since the show started, can you explain one more time, if people wanted to, if they had their own kayak and wanted to paddle out there, where would they go? Where would they turn? Where would they park? How does and how would they find the preserve?
Okay, so there's Jim Neville Marine Preserve is county property, open to anyone. There's a couple ways that you can get to it from land. You go from the Turtle Beach boat ramp and paddle out across the intercoastal, and then you head south to mile marker 43, and you got to keep your eyes open. We have not cleared mangroves to find this spot, so you need to kind of hug the coast to be able to see a little hidey hole, and when you look in there, you'll think, wow, I think that looks like a trail, and then you go in and it opens up. We tend to access it from Vamo Drive. It's a 15-minute paddle over there across the intercoastal. We have, if you want to come with us, and we can give you a tour and show you what we're doing out there, we do projects out there twice a month, and our projects are listed on our website under events, and you can register for that, and we can get you a kayak, or you can bring your own. And we're out there for about a half day, and it's a very pleasant time. It's not a slave drive. We're very conscientious of ages, abilities, interests, and heat. So taking all that into account, you can have a really good day out there. It's really beautiful. It's really quiet. It's easy to see birds. There's some raccoons and other animals out there. There's some beautiful plants, especially now that it's raining so much, and it's a surprising day.
Well, now I'm curious, what animals besides birds and raccoons do you see out there?
Raccoons, they did spot a coyote that had swam over there. Yeah, that was on the trail cam. And I believe there was some rabbit out there, which is pretty I don't know how that would happen unless a rabbit was taking flight and was the cargo was dropped. I'm not sure. But definitely raccoons are out there. There's some baby raccoons. And we can see that from the planting. When I talk about providing habitat, during the drought, we saw raccoons that actually were licking the sea grapes that we had planted out there to get the salt and the moisture from that. So, you know, we really believe that just the plants that we have provided are creating a difference out there.
So are there any rookeries out there in the mangroves?
I would think that there are. It's not like we're seeing nests per se, but they're all around there. Right before you go into the entrance, there's small spotty islands that are rookeries. There's always a large number of birds that are flying over, and there's a lot of dead stands, so there are places for them for their lookouts.
So we've talked about the habitat that was colonized by invasive species from other continents, and we've talked about the mangroves, but there are a couple of teeny-weeny really unique habitats, and those are the salt terns or salt flats. So occasionally between mangroves and higher land, you get a situation where seawater will come in on a high tide and evaporate. It doesn't all drain out. And over time, it becomes more and more saline. And so you end up with a flat, sandy area, sometimes with buttonwood mangroves, sometimes with no trees. And it's open. It's an open habitat, but almost no plants can grow there. There's some bacteria, sort of pinkish bacteria that can grow there. And so if you look at an aerial photograph, you can spot them. But I think if you tried to find them, you'd have to push through a lot of vegetation.
You do.
Yeah.
You do. There are areas out there that are that type of salt tern habitat that you're talking right. about, and you are kind of struggling to get through mangroves. You know, I think pretty much anything you do out there at one point or another, I always call it mangrove yoga because you've got to be able to flex and move to get through there. But those salt tern areas, they're loaded with fiddler crabs, of course. They're the primary species that I see out there.
Yeah. And you can see some interesting shorebirds, and there's some interesting things going on, and they're in decline because so many people dredge mosquito ditches and things like that to drain areas like that so that they don't persist as much as they once did. So I'll give you a chance. Think about what you'd like to add. I did want to announce something related to Fogartyville. So this Friday, July 24th at 8 p.m., John Ford and Joe Smothers will be at Fogartyville, a double bill of American roots music. And on July 28th at 6 p.m., there'll be a candidate forum for the District 2 Commission candidates. So think about that. That would be a good opportunity to hear your county commission candidates. So are any final words you have?
Final words about the Jim Neville.
Yeah.
Primarily, it is public property. You're welcome to go out there. You know, always proceed with caution with something like that. It's a beautiful place. You should be able to get around via the trail system. We are very open to taking groups out there. So if you have a group that you would like to have out there, let us know, and we can arrange an event around that. And if land restoration, vegetative restoration like this isn't your bag, Sarasota Baywatch has other projects that we do, and you can find those on our website.
Fantastic. You've been listening to our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio, 96.5 FM. Broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV, LP Radio 100.1, Bradenton, or listen online.
Today's show, number 92, was recorded on July 21st, 2026, and featured Rhonda Ryan about the Jim Neville Preserve.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own. Do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group
Org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group Our Changing Environment.
Tune in at 9 next week for the Healthy Living Hour with Dr. Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in.